Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey, everyone. Welcome. Thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, my bookshop. And our guest today is Eric Mykrantz, author of The Reincarnationist Papers, originally self-published in 2009. The backstory of this book, its history and its future history, if you will, are as fascinating as the book itself, and we'll let Eric talk about that a bit. Suffice it to say, a dozen years later, the film version, Infinite, has been in the can for a while, but delayed some due to COVID. And it's now scheduled to premiere, and we'll double check with him, in September of this year. It has an all-star cast, Mark Wahlberg, who you all know, and Chiwetel Ejiofor, nominated for the Academy Award for his performance in 12 Years a Slave. And also Dylan O'Brien, one of my daughter's favorites, and mine too, star of the Maze Runner trilogy, one of my favorites, both in the movies and the books, which are big sellers in YA and our bookshop. So I'm really looking forward to the movie. The book is incredibly cinematic, so it almost feels like it doesn't even need a screenplay. So The Reincarnationist Papers is a difficult book to pigeonhole. Not that I really like doing that anyway, but it's kind of science fiction, kind of fantasy, kind of mystery, kind of thriller, and kind of a love story of sorts. And we all love the idea of returning life after life. And, you know, that is the present or the fate that Evan has to live with over and over again. He's not alone, but his newly found friends that he's led to by the beautiful and seductive Poppy are complex characters who you might or might not want to meet in the dark alley. The papers read like the diary of a tormented and tragic soul, but also one who has been enlightened to a certain extent, and certainly more self-aware at the end of the book than he was at the beginning. So welcome, Eric, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Sam. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
So tell us a little bit before we start talking about the book, because the backstory really is fascinating. Talk about it, how it all came to be.
Yeah, so I self-published the novel in 2009, and I took it out to get it traditionally published to agents and a couple of publishers. And, you know, as is not unusual, I was, you know, met with some rejection on that front. I think maybe because partially to your point, Sam, that the book is a little difficult to pigeonhole and it kind of crosses a couple of genres. But what I decided to do, since I was looking for an agent anyway, and I was willing to pay an agent's commission or fee to help me get the book to a wider audience, I actually brought a page from my day job. And my day job is in IT. I've been working for the Oracle Corporation for 20 years. And one of the things that we do in IT is we routinely ask our end consumers to collaborate with us and to help us achieve some goal with our product. And we call that crowdsourcing. Like, some good examples that you might be familiar with are Wikipedia, Linux operating system is another one, where you define a goal and then you basically turn people loose to go get that goal. So what I did is I put a reward on the first page of the book that would offer an agent's commission to any reader who read the book and loved it and could make an introduction to a Hollywood producer, New York publisher, where that introduction would see the book into wider release, that I would basically pay them for that introduction after the movie was done or after the book was out. And Sam, this seems like sort of the craziest message in a bottle marketing idea right up until it works. Because it was about a year and a half later that I got an email on Thanksgiving Day. An assistant to a Hollywood director found a copy of The Reincarnationist Papers in a hostel in Nepal and read it like in one sitting and loved it and emailed me and said, oh my gosh, I work in Hollywood. This book is such a movie. Is this reward still available? Because I'd love to make this into a movie. And, you know, the old saying in publishing, right, is you're going to see a lot of rejections, but you only need one yes. Rafi was my one yes. And we signed an agreement and he went to work. It took him several years, but Rafi Crone eventually got the book placed with Paramount Pictures.
Yeah, and I read about how Chris Evans was first, but he had scheduling difficulties. And then you got these three people that are like definitely class A actors. It's amazing. I'm so looking forward to it. I've told everyone in the bookstore about it. And so did you pay, first of all, the idea of him finding it in Nepal in a hostel is just like, it's just so much like the book. It's like,
yeah,
it's like cognomina, you know, it's like, you know, it's like some secret society or something.
I know. And, you know, I don't think it was intentional, but I think that there are one or two scenes that were actually of the movie that were actually filmed in Nepal.
That's so cool.
That'll be a nice homage.
Well, I was going to ask you later if you believed in reincarnation, but do you believe in karma? such a karma thing.
I know. And, you know, if it were fiction,
I wouldn't believe it.
You wouldn't believe it, right? It'd be too hokey.
Yeah. Well, so did you pay Rafi both for getting the book published and the movie, or how did that end up working?
No. So the reward was to be paid after I got paid from the movie studio. So once, and the way that these contracts work is you get a movie option on your book, and then as soon as they start making the movie, the contract is complete. Sort of first day of principal shooting, I think is the term. So as soon as they started shooting the movie, Paramount paid me on the contract, and then I turned around and gave Rafi his reward out of that, just like you would with a regular agent transaction. Now, after that, the literary agents and the publisher found me after that, because, you know, it was on, you know, Variety, it was on Deadline Hollywood, and all of those news sites. And so everything that I was trying to get accomplished back in 2009 sort of came to me in 2019 after Rafi had brokered the deal with Bellevue Productions and then eventually with Paramount.
That's so funny the way, you know, you're working for Oracle, half your time in Oracle, you're sitting there just, and all of a sudden someone finds it. It reminds me, I've interviewed Andy Weir twice, the guy who did The Martian.
Exactly.
Same thing, exactly.
It is.
Selling it for 99 cents on Kindle, and 2 years later, Matt Damon's on Mars.
Exactly.
It's a completely different world.
Yeah. You're not the first one to draw those parallels between me and Andy and how we've basically leveraged the power of our readers to, you know, jumpstart our career.
Yeah, and I just interviewed him for Hail Mary, and it's already a movie with Ryan Gosling.
It's so amazing. I can't wait for it. So Hail Mary launches on the same day as the Reincarnations Papers, by the way, May 4th.
No pun intended. They both watch. Well, you know, it's funny because you are a travel writer, mm-hmm. in addition to Oracle. And so travel writing figures to a certain extent in the book as well, correct? I mean,
it does, because, yeah, it you know, these characters live, let's just say, enriched lives, right? They have the benefit of, you know, the experience and the accumulated knowledge of multiple lifetimes, as well as accumulated wealth over multiple lifetimes through the secret society. And it allows for a very sort of cosmopolitan, international flavor to the second half of the book. And a lot of that was influenced by the time that I lived in Europe and some of the travel writing that I did when I lived there.
You know, something, you know, about the secret society, it reminded me a little bit of, I don't know, The Magus or Eyes Wide Shut, or there's a couple other books in which you have these society, like the Rosicrucians or the Templars, and it was just like that. And it's interesting, and we can talk about each character individually. But let's first talk about Evan. And he has a kind of a short rope here with his immortality. Evan only has two lives behind him. Some of these other guys, like Clovis, has been around for eons. So talk a little bit about how the process works and where Evan finds himself in this situation.
So Evan starts off in the book alone and living a very sort of isolated and solitary existence because he has total recall of two past lives, meaning skills, languages, loves, losses, everything. But that's a very sort of unique existence. And, you know, Sam, if you, at the end of the day at Wellington Square, if you went and turned to one of your coworkers and said, oh, hey, by the way, we've been working together for years, but I actually have these two complete other lives that I remember everything for, your relationship with him would be different after that conversation. So he really keeps to himself because he believes that he's sort of alone and unique in the world until he accidentally stumbles into Poppy, who recognizes him for what he is, because she's exactly like him, except she's older. And then she introduces him into the Cognomina, which is the secret society of these folks that reincarnate over and over again and prefer to associate with each other via the secret society. So they'll come back again in new bodies over and over, but they would remember the same personality and the same experience from the people before.
It's funny, in the beginning, I thought, oh, it's a little far-fetched that they end up together. And then I realized, no, it's not far-fetched at all, because they keep coming back and chances are, not like in our lives, but chances are they are going to meet people yeah. that are like them. So it took me a couple minutes to get, okay, it's not as much of a coincidence as it seems to be at first.
Yeah. And then once you do meet another one like you, then they would start sort of, you know, the personalities and the individuals would start aggregating around this society. And that was sort of the core of the society, would be a way for them to meet each other again, lifetime after lifetime.
Yeah, go back to the same, you know, it's funny because Diltz, who's really a nice guy, I really like him a lot, especially when he has dinner with him and all that. And he's like the butler in the Keanu Reeves, John Wick's movie.
Have yes. Seen,
yeah, he's like him, you know, just such a nice guy and so obsequious, but not in a, it's not like he's a servant at all. He's a peer.
Right.
And talk a little bit about the headquarters.
So the headquarters, for lack of a better term, it is a headquarters, is a mysterious hotel in Zurich, Switzerland. And it's a bit mysterious because you couldn't make a reservation there. You couldn't sort of walk in and get a room. It's a bit, now you talked about John Wick earlier. Some people have compared it to the Continental in the John Wick series, right? Where it's a hotel ostensibly, but it's where they go and gather and they'll live there for a while. They have their meetings there. They meet there at least once a year to fraternize with each other. And it's where any new members that are brought in or discovered by any of the 28 members of the Cognomina have to come for their entry, which is a sort of a trial of sorts that in the book I call an ascension trial, where they have to prove, and it ends up being researched, facts from their previous lives that they actually are a reincarnationist like these other members of the society.
One of the things I liked about the book is there were all these little, not Easter eggs, but little things in it, like the fact that the door locks from the inside.
And it didn't have a doorknob on the outside.
Yeah, it doesn't. And I thought, wait a minute, okay, I understand exactly why that's true. But you know, that's something those kinds of little things are things you don't often see. So the two past lives, Vasily, the Hungarian soldier, that's cool too, the way that Ramsay is so interested in his boss, so to speak.
Right.
But he's what he is, and you can understand his life. But Bobby, the second incarnation, this is problematic. So yeah, Bobby has a very difficult childhood. And the interesting thing about the characters is you don't realize this reincarnation until you come of a certain age.
Right. Yeah. These reincarnationists, they leave normal lives until they're 16, 17, 18 years old. And then the memories from the previous incarnations start to come to them very slowly at first, and then in a rush all at once. so that they begin, so that their personalities begin to build out with all of the other people that they were before as they recall those memories. And that was very purposeful when I wrote it, because I thought, man, how torturous would it be to be a 2 or 3 or 4 year old and then have all that knowledge? That would just drive people crazy. That would be just a recipe for psychosis.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to live like that.
Yeah, so I designed it so that there would be, you know, remembering at 17, 18.
Yeah, and that's why Bobby has, well, do you want to talk about what Evan's profession is?
Absolutely. It's, you know, on the cover of the book are the flames. So you're getting my virtual background there. So yeah, there is a fire element to the book. And fire is actually sort of a character in a way.
Exactly.
Because, you know, Bobby, like you said, he has a tragic childhood where he's ends up causing a house fire accidentally that kills his mother and kills him. And so he never gets old enough to remember the first life, Vasily's life as the soldier. So Evan actually recalls both of their lives when he turns 17, 18, and he's trying to piece this all together with no mentor, no guide, no roadmap. And this is why he sort of lives this very different, very isolated existence in LA. But the one thing that is a touchstone to his past is fire. Because he remembers the way that Bobby died in that second incarnation. And that is the one thing that recognizes him for who he is now. It's sort of the transcendental character in with Evan and his first couple of lives. And it ends up being a very important touch point for him. And he's a professional arsonist because of that.
And one of the seminal scenes in the book is, and at first it seems rather plebeian, but is when he climbs the stairs to the room that he's going to set up. There's this, as you say, fire's almost like, yeah, it is a character there. And at first you just think, okay, yeah, he's just going to drop the lighter, but he doesn't. He communes with the fire, and the idea is he wants to control it because he couldn't control it before.
Exactly.
And that scene was really, oh, that'll be great in the movie. God, if they do that.
Yeah, if they do that.
Yeah, they should, because yeah, they should do that. Oh, and the other thing is I really liked is, and I know I'm doing popular culture, but is Henry, the bartender, reminds me of the bartender in Deadpool.
And yes.
And he's like this nice guy, but he's going like, I wouldn't, nah, she's trouble. I wouldn't.
Yeah, not her.
Well, that's what I was saying somewhat flippantly at the outset about these guys. You might not want to meet them, or you might want to meet them. That's the thing, that one of the things that was intriguing is that I thought this brotherhood, sisterhood was one in which everyone was loyal to one another all the time. And for most of the book, and without getting into spoilers, they indeed are. But there are some points of inflection where that doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen because primarily, in many cases, because of something that happened in a life before.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Those experiences transcend with their personalities.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about, this is not really a spoiler, but the fact that Samus and Poppy had this relationship going on that kind of led them to be not indebted. What's the word? They resent it.
They, I think the word that I like to use is there's an enmity between them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it all goes back 400 years to when Samus, who is one of the older reincarnationists and has had, over a dozen lives, was trying to find his fortune as a conquistador, a Spanish conquistador, exploring in the New World in what would now be New Mexico. And he actually finds Poppy's character, because Poppy is in the wrong place
yeah.
for that character. And this ends up being sort of a familiar theme in how Poppy finds Evan and how Samus finds Poppy, is these people are not where they should be, right? So Poppy is trying to find her first family, the family before. So that's a key for Samus to say, hey, oh, there might be something else going on here. And then befriends Poppy, and tries to help her find her village. But when they do, it ends up having catastrophic effects for the village that Poppy's trying to find, which is her first family. And then at the end of that, right, she actually sees some of Samus's true character and what he was trying to do all along, which is to basically use other people to enrich himself and to sort of ensure his future and his standing with the rest of the Cognomina.
Well, it's true that most of the characters in the book, maybe not Clovis, but most of them, their concept of how they should handle themselves during these lives is a very hedonistic one. You know, just enjoy yourself, because there isn't, and some are more adamant about it than others, there isn't this faith that you should have because there isn't anything out there.
Well, and that was a very logical conclusion for me when I was writing the book is, you know, when you talk about reincarnation, the first thing that you think of are, you know, Eastern philosophies, Eastern religions, right? Karma, continuing to improve yourself, iteration after iteration until you reach a transcendental state in nirvana where you go to the next spiritual level. But what happens if that's not there? What happens if you just come back and your station does not improve with virtuous behavior in the previous lives? What happens if your station doesn't degrade with base behavior in your previous lives? What would happen? How would you live your life if you knew that there were no consequences for your actions? And that's really one of the underlying messages in the book, but it's kind of a dangerous one, right? Because, you know, you let that sort of, you know, you let that thing out of Pandora's box. And, you know, morality goes straight out the window.
Yeah. And the thing about it is, you know, I just thought of the relationship between Poppy and Samus. It's like in the end of Kill Bill, where Uma Thurman's sitting there with David Carradine. She goes, "We have unfinished business."
Exactly. Exactly. And she gets her unfinished business at the end, which I love.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, how do you know she's coming that way? I mean, and, you know, the way she says, you don't want to use him as an advocate. And he says, you don't really want to use her as an advocate.
Right.
But they don't really come out and say it. And he's kind of stuck in the middle the whole way. It's just like, you know, I thought, okay, they're going to be loyal. They're always going to be loyal to one another because it serves their interest.
Right.
Not to double cross each other.
Right.
And that was an interesting point, counterpoint to the book. Who can I trust?
Yeah. Who can I trust?
Hey, so I was thinking when I was asking you about the flames and all, this movie's been in the can, so you've seen the movie, right?
I have not.
You haven't?
I have not seen the movie, Sam. So I went on set in October, November 2019, and when it was being shot in the UK, and then they filmed through, I think it was like January, February, right up to when COVID started. And then they shut down production normally, meaning I think that they had finished all their shooting and it went into post-production. And I think that they had some delays in post-production around some of the sound editing, because some of those things have to be done like in the studio. And by then we were already in March and in lockdown. And so I have not seen the movie. And, you know, I think that they did a few test screenings with Paramount executives that really loved it. And a couple of the producers were talking about it being sort of Matrix-like, which I think would be very cool because I'm a huge fan of that series. And I just love the Wachowskis and everything that they do. I hope that it's in that line, but no, I have not seen it. So I'll be very curious to see it. I don't know, with restrictions opening up, Sam, if I'll be able to see a screening of it before September 24th, or if I'll just be able to see it at the premiere like everybody else.
Yeah. And not to like sound condescending, but here you are at Oracle for 20 years. You have a self-published book. Not only is it found and made into a movie, but you have who gets three A characters. How do you get three characters, and how do you pay them for this novel, and who knows what it's going to be like? It's just, you got three incredible actors.
I know. And, you know, yeah, Chiwetel Ejiofor, really, you know, Oscar nominated for 12 Years a Slave, but any true sci-fi fans out there are going to remember him from Serenity, right?
Exactly.
He was the bad guy.
And then Maze Runner, and like it goes right into it.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, I love all of their work. And, you know, I got to meet Mark Wahlberg on set and just the nicest guy. Just, I mean, as nice as you would think that he would be from all of the coverage that he gets.
Yeah.
Seriously, just the nicest, like most professional journeyman attitude about his craft.
And Chris Evans would have been great too. Another nice.
Yeah. Guy. Yeah. I agree. Listen, I'm not asking for any refunds on this. No. I think Mark's going to be, you know, I saw what Mark was doing on set. He's going to be pretty awesome.
It's funny in the book to go back to it. We're trying to sell it anyway, so we should talk about it.
Yes. Buy it at Wellington Square.
Exactly. And come by when you can. Clovis is an interesting, is it pronounced Clovis?
Clovis, yes.
Yeah. Clovis is an interesting character because he's been around a long time and he's gotten over this hedonistic thing. But then at the same time, he's become, at least to Evan, kind of boring in a way, right?
Yes. In the same way that, you know, an aesthetics lifestyle might be a bit, you know, underwhelming for, you know, someone who's young. It might not be the lifestyle that you would want.
Yeah, and that's what I wondered about. After all this and over and over and over again, do you just run out of not only things to do, but run out of, you know, you can only buy a Lamborghini, you know, 10 times.
Right, exactly. So, you know, Clovis has spent, you know, the last few lives sort of looking for a deeper meaning and living by himself in Yemen, on the coast of Yemen. And the best way that I describe him is he's a threadbare soul.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. And I didn't expect that either. I expected that when Evan stayed with him, he'd find an enlightened, like you were talking earlier about.
Right.
An enlightened human being rather than someone that was kind of like on the downslope, especially when there were certain things he was doing that were clear. Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm not going to get into spoilers.
Right.
Yeah. But then you have got, you know, you have Poppy who lives an incredibly hedonistic life.
Oh, yes.
And enjoys it. But she's been around a while too, but not as long.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And, you know, and it, again, you take the consequence out of their existence, right? Because, you know, death really holds no terrors for them because they, you know, once you've come back once and remembered a past life, after you do that a couple of times, you're going to have a confidence that if you were to walk out of your house and get hit by a bus, that you would come back again and remember this life. Remember this conversation with Sam from Wellington Books, 17, 18 years from now, when you're in a new body, in a new incarnation. So that takes a lot of the risk out of it for them. So they can lead these sort of very libertine lifestyles where, you know, they can use drugs, they'll take extraordinary risks in their lives and their careers, and because they'll know that they'll get to do it over again. They're living on a longer timeline, and because of that, they have this sort of enriched existence.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, as you alluded to earlier, how they can amass an enormous amount of wealth, and that wealth is kind of warehoused for them in a fairly well-constructed system by the secret society.
Yeah, and administered by Mr. Deltz.
Yeah, yeah, I do. He's like my hero. I don't know why, but he really is. Yeah, it's funny because at first I thought, okay, well, it's still going to suck to die because it may hurt. And then afterwards, it's going to take a long time before you realize. But then I realized you're not going to know that. You know, it's like all of us. We're swimming through this dark sea. We pop up for a little bit, look around, and then we go back and swim forever. And maybe we pop up again somewhere, but it doesn't bother us. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah.
And it took me a while in the pages to realize that there really isn't any downside for them. They're not, until they become self-aware of their previous existence, you know, they're just in neutral. They're just chilling.
Yeah. And I explore this concept a little more in the second book, There's actually going to be at least three books in the series. The second book is, I'm actually looking at drafts number 6 right here on my desk right now. I was working on that at 5 a.m. this morning. Some of them actually prefer that sort of interlude between when they died in the previous existence and when they remember in the next incarnation, because that's as close as they ever get to leading a normal life. because once they fully mature and they hit that 16, 17, 18 year mark where the memories of those other lives come back to them, that's when their world totally changes, or actually probably better said, totally reverts back to the timeline they were on before. But until then, they could, you know, grow up, go to junior high school, play on the football team, have a normal life until that. And then we're like, oh my gosh, all of these lives are coming back. And I'm actually not Sam Hankin, on these other people, this collection of other people through time.
One thing that's kind of nebulous is almost like, you do know, it doesn't, for our readers, does it happen right away? Is it a gradual process? We see what happens with Evan, but the ones who have done it over and over again, do they then realize, okay, that day I wake up?
No, it's a slow process, but it gets easier the more times it happens to you. So for Evan, because he's only had two lives, it's actually sort of a really difficult transition for him and a really difficult thing for him to reconcile the lives of Vasily and Bobby into his everyday existence. But by the time you're as old as Poppy or Samus, it becomes a much easier transition to reconcile all of those past lives and remember who you were before, because that is sort of a trajectory throughout history. And then you realize that basically you're the next stage on that trajectory going forward.
I just realized, considering the way the book began, if you're going to do a second book, is it going to have the same kind of structure?
Great question. It'll have the same characters. Some of the appearances might be different for obvious reasons, but it will have a different structure. It will have a found footage feel about it, but it'll have a slightly different structure than what you read, Sam.
Okay, well, as we get near the end of the book, and I guess the interview, Reginald was a great character too.
Yes, I loved him.
And the thing about Reginald is, why is he so happy? I mean, I know he's getting out, but he just is, he hasn't suffered that much, and he's just happy as a clam.
He's happy to have, you know, another, he's happy to have a cellmate, right? He's happy to have someone to interact with.
Another infidel.
Another infidel, yes.
And that was, you know, also a pivotal point in the book, because here you have Evan doing something, well, doing something very, very, very important. And relying on the history of his first incarnation to make things a little more complicated. But I thought, okay, why isn't he just, you know how the book starts out. I mean, there's this thing hanging and he's ready mm-hmm. to, you know. And I thought, well, he could do that too. But the last few pages are more like, you know, if you're reading Ayn Rand and reading The Fountainhead, and all of a sudden Nathaniel Brandon comes in and gives you a little treatise about what things really are like. It was kind of like that, not in the boring way he does it, but it's kind of like he's explaining exactly what's going on, and he's not in any particular rush.
Right.
I was thinking I might be, but then I thought, would I be? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I do know what you mean. By the way, thank you for qualifying the comparison of me to Ayn Rand. I appreciate the comparison. I appreciate the qualification, because I enjoy your writing, but it is a little boring sometimes. By the time we get to the end, right? I mean, you know, Evan is in a way sort of our guide in our introduction into this society of these sort of unique and enriched characters that live over and over again and exist on a longer timeline than we do. And at the very end, I sort of wanted to take this one step further and really have it get a little existential for the reader itself, right? As to, if you put yourself in this position, what choice would you make? Would you make a fast choice? Would you make a slow choice? Would you deliberate about it? Would you write about it? For posterity's sake, or even for a future you to recognize. And I sort of left it a bit open there for the reader to take it in the direction that they want to.
Yeah, and again, not to violate your rules, but when he went to the place he went to, he could have just taken a step.
Mm-hmm.
That he could have just crossed a real line.
And a metaphorical and a literal line.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so funny because, you know, some of my readers, some of my customers, when we have our book club, which I call Fight Club, you know, they all said, why did he do this? Why did it end this way? I don't know what happened, blah, blah, blah. But the idea is, in the discrete sense, discrete, C-R-E-T-E, in the discrete sense, you look at it at the beginning and you go, okay, well, this is going to end, and it will end. Because it should. And you think, okay, well, then we all know what's going to happen, and the book is wrapped up tight. And it's not that at all. Because you're, even if you didn't say you were doing a sequel, you would still be, as a reader, and it's always good to give the reader work, you know? And so at the end, you'd be wondering, I wonder, okay, what, something has to happen.
Right.
It's not often that you have a book where something has to happen. And this book, it does. You almost can't stop. In fact, you could be doing this for the rest of your life.
From your lips to God's ears, right? Let's hope that's true, Sam, because I enjoy it. I enjoy reading. I really enjoy book clubs. I really enjoy interacting with readers after they've read the book. It's such an interesting experience as an author to hear what people gravitate to and to what they really resonate with in the book. You know, some people love Diltz. Some people just totally skip over Diltz, right? Some people love the flashbacks, the historical flashbacks in the book, and really focus on that. Others really focus on the philosophy of the book.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think about that. The fact, you know, sometimes you read a book and each chapter is devoted to another character, but you don't like one of the characters and you go, oh, no, not another chapter about her. And you almost want to skip ahead. But yeah, the flashbacks really, it's not that you would like them or not anyway, but it gives you so much more background and reasoning. You don't, in the present, you might not understand something, but all of a sudden, okay, that's why this is this way.
That's why Poppy hates Samus, is because something that happened 400 years ago, a character flaw that was exposed 400 years ago.
But then like Ramsay, that's a pretty good part too. And she's, and you're in the wrong body. It's not the body you want to be in your next reincarnation. That would really suck. That would really suck.
Well, and some readers have brought this up to me that, you know, you were going to ask the question, do I believe in reincarnation or not? And we can get into that if you want. But some of the readers say, well, can this explain, you know, how people feel like they're misgendered? Because they might have, you know, if they remembered something from a past life, and I'm not saying that I believe in it or I don't believe in it. I don't really get that metaphysical about it. I have some metaphysical touch points there, but I wanted to write a book that had these characters developed over a very long timeline. And I didn't want them to be vampires. I wanted them to be something else. And so this could, you know, so when I wrote the book, I was very careful about gender, because some people, some of these reincarnationists really identify with one gender, and that's their preferred gender, but they might not be born into that biological body in that incarnation. And so, you know, so they identify with their preferred gender that they've had in previous lives that they feel more comfortable with.
Yeah.
And Ramsay's one of them. You know, Poppy talks about preferring to be a woman, even though she's been a man in several of her lives.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, but it's very true. And actually, it's a very opportune time. Well, and speaking of times, I mean, you would normally be out on tour now, and COVID, the COVID paradox is here you are stuck talking to me. Otherwise, you'd be out signing books and plugging them. That's the other cool thing about your book. It's the first time, might be the first time, that a book comes in with the cover already emblazoned with now a major motion picture.
I know.
Yeah, that never happens.
And then the other thing that's on the cover is I had a really important author read the book and give me a really great blurb on it. So Diana Gabaldon of Outlander fame, right, read the Reincarnationist papers and gave me a really wonderful blurb that's on the cover of the book as well. And I'm just so thankful to her that she would you know, as such an accomplished professional in what she's doing, that she would take time to read a debut novel by an unknown author, and then really do that courtesy for me. It was amazing.
And then the other thing that's good is I would encourage everyone to go to your website, because you can't see it in the book, and I researched it, so I did. But you see the way the original book had on, you know, had the reward, because I just have the PDF. But you know, has the page in which you outlined the unknown contract you were making with somebody.
Right. Yeah, I was basically empowering and crowdsourcing readers to be an army of agents for me, and it was an interesting
idea that no one has ever thought of. I mean, I have so many people who come into the bookstore that ask me, "Oh, I want to self-publish my book," and I have to explain to them that they probably really do not want to do that.
Right.
I mean, it's easier with Kindle now and with saying 99 cents, which is what Andy Weir did, but. And the other one was called Wool. I think it was called Wool, a series of science fiction books. But yeah, it's very difficult to do. And it's an interesting industry right now. And you realize—
It really is. The key for me is just interacting with readers, right? Interacting with consumers. You're an independent bookseller. You're my hero. Right. You're out there providing this service to your community. My community in Denver, Colorado, it's Tattered Cover. Right. I shop at Tattered Cover. And, you know, it's just a different experience than you can get anywhere else. And we need to protect that. We need to treasure that. The thing that I like, and I hope you do it at your store, I'll eventually find out when I'm in the Philly area and I can go and visit you, is love the staff picks. I just love to see what the booksellers like, because this is sort of an important feature that you don't get through Amazon. You don't get it through big box stores. It's sort of readers talking to readers, and really there's sort of an intimacy there that I hope we always keep, Sam.
Yeah. I've never really even hired anyone. They just fall into the store.
Yeah.
You know, and we always have a group of people that are exactly the same. We're not going to have a Trump supporter. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
You know, I've interviewed 700 authors. I don't think I've interviewed one Trump supporter. And I realize that's because writers are intelligent. It makes perfect sense. And there are two things in the bookstore. One, I have library ladders, which is one of my lifelong dreams. And so when you climb the library ladder, not only do you find the book you're looking for, but you find the book on either side.
Right.
And Amazon can give you all kinds of recommendations, but they're not going to give you the book on either side.
Right.
And that's the book that may be the one. It could be your book.
And, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's that, and the fact that, as you said, the staff mix, the books are curated. You know, there's somebody that's history, there's somebody that's biography, there's somebody that's young adult. So it works out perfectly.
Yeah. And then when you find that person that's sort of your recommender, your staff picker, you know, you'll go back to the store just to see what they're reading next and pick it up.
And they do.
I do.
Yeah, there's one guy, Mike, who's really good, and he looks like me. So people come in and they thank me for recommending a book, and I go, "Oh, no problem." But they're thanking him because he recommended it, not me.
Right.
So I love that, because I don't know what I'm doing. So anyway, thanks so much, Eric, for joining us today. And everybody has got to be looking forward to this movie, especially when we come out of this, because it's going to happen. It's going to actually be kind of perfect timing, I think, don't you?
I hope so. It certainly looks that way. Like I got my vaccine last week, and I'm ready to go. And I'm ready to go to the movies, that's for sure. So Infinite comes out September 24th. Reincarnations Papers is out May 4th. And get it at Wellington.
Yeah, well, it'll be on the front table, and it'll be in the window. And it's like, you know, perfect setup, because once this gets out, like I said, it's just so unusual and great that you got three guys that everybody is going to know.
I know. Yeah.
Very unusual.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oh yeah. Someone told me, you know, recently, is that if you're going to succeed, you need luck, you need to hustle, and then you need to have talent. Talent really being first doesn't really work that much.
Right. Yeah. And I find the more I hustle, the luckier I get, Sam.
That's what my dad used to say. You make your own luck.
Right.
You know, if you're laying in bed, an opportunity knocks and you just stay in bed.
Right.
Big mistake.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Thanks again. Look forward to seeing you.
Hey, thanks, Sam. Yeah, definitely. When we're all back to normal and I'm on the East Coast, I definitely want to check in and check out Wellington.
Okay. We'll be waiting.
All right. All right. Bye.
See ya.